Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight where Nick Cater makes his inaugural address to the Sydney Institute. He's well known to many of you. I will introduce him briefly. On the occasion of the very successful publication of The Lucky Culture and the Rise of an Australian Ruling Class, which has come out recently, and Janet Grundy's got copies of The Lucky Culture here tonight, and I'm sure Nick would be happy to sign any copies. Now, I will introduce our speaker briefly. Nick Cater is a journalist and has been a senior editor at The Australian since 2004. He began his career at the BBC in London, and he has worked for News Limited in Adelaide, Canberra and in Sydney, and as a foreign correspondent in Asia. And as I said, he's here on the occasion of the publication of The Lucky Culture, and Nick Cater's address to the Sydney Institute tonight is on the topic, 40 Years in the Making, Why Leadership is the Least of Labor's Troubles. Nick, you're very welcome.
Thank you, Gerard, and thank you for inviting me. I'm most honoured. And just bear with me, this is a bit of an experiment today, but there's a wonderful iPad app where you're supposed to be able to scroll your speech. So it's the first time I've used it. So if I start talking very quickly or slow right down, you'll know there's a problem with it. I've got the hard copy here just in case. I was thinking about this speech. I was reminded when I turned up in Adelaide 24 years ago next Tuesday week, I think, July 9. I had got a job at the Advertiser, and being very new to town, a bit like John McTernan really, I didn't have a clue about Australian politics, but it was the days before Google, and the Chief of Staff said, well, we've got a job for you. He said, we're doing a series called Where Are They Now? And I thought, uh-oh, here's trouble. And he sent me off to interview somebody called Des Corcoran. I was rather too shy, being my first day, to ask anybody what Des Corcoran's claim to fame was, so I turned up on his doorstep and just fronted up. I said, Des, I'm here to do a story, where are they now? First question, if you'll excuse me, is where are you then? And he explained that, yes, he'd been the Premier of South Australia and fought a career and took me on his back deck and gave me a couple of beers and gave me a potted history of Labour. But I found that question, where were we then, quite a useful one whenever I've looked around to Australia to try to make sense of it, and it was the approach I took with this book. Before I could say why it is that we're now in this position where we have this enormous cultural divide, first of all, I had to make sense of how we got here, what sort of a country we were in prehistory. That's before 1989, before I arrived. So that's where I started. And on the question of the Labour Party, I'll just start with a little potted history of my own. Keating, Beazley, Crean, Latham, Beazley, Rudd, Gillard, Rudd. It's simply no longer credible, I'd suggest, to argue that Labour's problem is its leadership, that with just a little bit more bloodletting, Australia's oldest party will suddenly be back on track and electable again. It's clear to everybody that now I think that this institution is in deep structural decline with chronic problems that go back for many years. How many years? Well, I suggest at least 40. I didn't set out in The Lucky Culture to write a history of the Labour Party, but it seemed to me that some things needed to be straightened out. The official history of the Labour Party, the received history, if you like, the one Labour people tell themselves, seemed to me to be disingenuous in the extreme. It was littered with half-truths, with myths, strung together with a glorious narrative emanating from some indistinct light on the hill. But the characters were badly drawn. They were in black and white. There were heroes and there were villains. The heroes were lauded, the villains were virtually ignored. They'd been airbrushed from the official account with the audacity of a Soviet propagandist. Its history is being devised, of course, by the intelligentsia, which is hardly a neutral player in the Great Disruption, which is the seminal moment in the 1960s when Labour turned itself on its head. This was when the alumni took over the Workers' Party, much as they were later to take over the workers' cottages and began to rip out the fireplaces. According to the received account, the It's Time election, 1972, was a glorious national uprising when the Australian people overthrew the conservative colonial overlords and emerged blinking into the sunlight to greet the new dawn. The It's Time anthem reinforces this legend. Its history not as it happened, but as we imagine it happened. The evocative images of a choir, a congregation joined in worship, a gospel tune, for that's what it is, suggest that this was not so much an election as an anointing. It's as though Whitlam came to power not through a popular ballot, but through popular acclaim. Labour's Messiah complex starts at this point. Philip Adams once wrote, "He did not have ministers, he had apostles. We weren't voters, we were disciples. His weren't policies, they were miracles." The real story, of course, is somewhat more prosaic. Its Time was not, as it presents, the anthem that captured the zeitgeist of an entire nation. It was an attempt at persuasion. It was a tacit admission that much of middle Australia needed convincing that the country should change at all. It was evidence of a nervousness, I think, within Labour that the wider electorate might not be as captivated with the progressive narrative as the sophisticates were. Lurking in the background, there was that fear, which comes back time and time again, that there may be another Don's Party. In 1971, a year before the It's Time election, Labour's market research company, Spectrum International, discovered large pockets of voters who, in a choice between Whitlam and the incumbent, were mysteriously prepared to vote for Billy McMahon. And with the departure of Arthur Calwell and Robert Menzies, most young progressives had assumed that social conservatism would suffer some kind of Darwinian demise. But it was proving maddeningly resilient. Donald Horne in The Lucky Country described the language of the older political generation as obsolescent. Australians were spellbound in boredom, he said. And they were impatient to move on in a country that was run down, old-fashioned, puzzled, resentful. Yet the qualitative research that was commissioned by Labour said something quite different. The team at HR McCann Erickson delivered a brutally frank appraisal of Whitlam's weaknesses. In hindsight, in that we can read, I think, the early signs of the deep philosophical divisions, which barely registered at the time, but by 2013 had splintered the party. Overall, the surveys endorsed Labour's change of leadership in 67, demonstrating that Whitlam's modern approach broadened the party's appeal. In 1966, only 14% of professionals had voted for Calwell, but by 1972, 4 out of 10 were backing Whitlam. Even the bosses were warming. 21% of managers signalled their intention to vote Labour in 1972. That was up from 14% under Calwell. Support for Labour amongst skilled, semi-skilled and unskilled workers increased, the most significant gains being naturally among Catholics, and Whitlam was winning the youth vote. In 1966, Australians in their 20s overwhelmingly supported Harold Holt over Arthur Calwell, 53% to 32%. But by 72, Whitlam had turned that around, 50% for Labour, 35% for the coalition. Yet McCann's research had uncovered flaws in Whitlam's personality. Focus groups found him cold, distant, inhuman, an intellectual loner, they said, who gave impotent answers to potent questions. Significantly, voters seemed to be troubled by what the researchers euphemistically called special issues: land rights, tariff reductions, the environment, divorce law reform, race relations. Immigration, in fact, was a potential minefield, they said, for Labour. The coalition had dismantled the White Australia policy, or started to dismantle it, but Labour was going to pay the price. Researchers noted comments such as "vote Labour" and "get a nigger for a neighbour" were beginning to emerge. They urged Whitlam to pull back, to somehow argue that he would reduce all immigration, and Whitlam dutifully did. In an interview with David Frost, Whitlam, celebrated, you remember, as Labour's great multiculturalist, made this pledge: "I don't think the scale of migration, of which we've had up to now, is fair to the migrants or fair to the Australian." Four decades later, I argue that we can see this tension between Labour's intellectual progressive sentiments and the working class pragmatic social conservatism is yet to be resolved. Far from it. In fact, it's essentially the same source of Labour's current crisis. Just as Whitlam was obliged to repudiate the progressives' position on immigration, so Kevin Rudd is now forced to turn the switch on asylum seekers from fair to tough. The It's Time campaign would also set the pattern for how Labour would respond to this philosophical tension. Rather than reason it through, come to some kind of accommodation, Labour turned to the developing science of electioneering and the techniques which we would today call those used by spin doctors. Whitlam invested his trust in advertisers and marketers, fine-tuning his election platform in the light of their advice, stage-managing photo opportunities, softening his image by allowing his wife Margaret to take centre stage. For the first time, we're seeing a politician in Australia described as a product. And there was a product to sell, of course. The modernisation of Labour under Whitlam was the most startling metamorphosis of a party in Australian political history. In a single term, in opposition, the Workers' Party had been transformed from a bastion of socially conservative trade union working class members into a progressive reform movement. By unilaterally reinventing the party's purpose, Whitlam challenges Labour's claim of historical continuity, the faithful guardians of tradition, the keepers of the eternal flame. Yet the Reform Party was also able to reach beyond the proletariat to members of this new intelligentsia who were graduating in ever-increasing numbers from Robert Menzies' supersized universities. Its Time would be the first political campaign in Australia to abandon the raw, spontaneous rhetoric of the stump and embrace technocratic marketing. For the first time, a leader would seek endorsement not just as a leader, but as a brand. The party would be a brand. McCann compared Whitlam to Johnny Walker whiskey. And he noted that 50% of the market in the early 1970s was Johnny Walker, leaving 101 other brands in to share the rest. McCann said, "On taste tests, people can't tell one from another. What they really perceive is not the whiskey in the bottle, but what's imagined to be in the bottle." This was the framework around which the It's Time election was conceived. It's inherently contemptuous of the electorate itself, assuming that voters did not need intellectual persuasion. It was enough to pull the wool over their eyes. Whitlam would not be portrayed as the custodian of eternal Labour values, since they were damaged. They were damaged goods. He would be presented as the moderniser, whose task was to sweep away the past. He'd seek affirmation not from Labour's elders or founding fathers, but from its celebrities and youth. Labour's gain of 8 seats gave it a majority on the floor of the House, but it was hardly amounted to a national consensus. Whitlam won the seats in outer suburban Sydney and Melbourne, but there were swings against the ALP in South Australia, Western Australia and outback Queensland. Labour gained 12 seats, but lost 4, 2 in the West, 1 each in South Australia and Western Australia. Alan Reid wrote later, "It was as though for Whitlam's advisers and consequently for the ALP, Australia stops where the pavements of Sydney and Melbourne ended. It was an attitude for which the ALP was to pay dearly at the 1975 election." The cleverness, or perhaps even the carelessness, of the It's Time slogan is it left open the question, it's time for what? In 1972, the It's Time slogan danced around the internal philosophical tension within the party that Whitlam single-handedly had attempted to reinvent. It was a master trope of non-prescriptive politics, like Barack Obama's hope we can believe in. Its time was a blank slate upon which people could project their own vision for the future. There are risks, however, in this sort of strategy. By leaving so much to the imagination, an incoming Prime Minister is hostage to the electorate's fancies and is obliged to attempt to be all things to all men. The worst danger is that, having confused the voters, a party starts to become confused itself about what it stands for. Until the 1960s, the ALP was a party of muscular unionism, run by a cadre of shop floor arrivists. They were indifferent and at times openly hostile to intellectuals. The long hairs, Jack Lang called them. Dreamers, the sons of wealthy parents, overtaken by misty idealism, who preferred the philosophy of William Morris to that of Karl Marx or Engels. The antipathy was mutual. In Horne's estimation, the average union leader was petty and conservative, not very good at his job. Their organisations were amateurish and irrelevant to the life of modern Australia. Whitlam, biding his time as deputy leader in the early 1960s, saw the educated middle class as his natural allies. It was a growing cohort. Robert Menzies had initiated the expansion of higher education in the late 1950s, but those who benefited from it were largely, by and large, felt happier with the progressive side of politics than the Liberal Party, although, of course, there were some exceptions. In Whitlam's view, the compact between the thinkers and the workers would be essential to a modern technocratic, social democratic government. It was the job of universities to train these people. First, however, though, he had to tame the ALP's anti-intellectual tendencies. And they were strong. Writing in Meanjin in 1965, Arthur Burns said that when he tried to join the party, he'd been made to feel like a permanent pre-adult, a member of a class that the other ALP members were against. The relationship between Brain and Braun was less troubled in Britain, where the Fabian intellectuals had helped build the Labour Party in 1900. In the United States, the Democrats had avoided any firm formal agreement with organised labour, and in France, it seemed that intellectualism was not only compatible with socialism, but compulsory. The Australian labour movement, however, was a product of its time and place. It began with a brotherhood of agricultural brawlers with a rather brutal attempt to collective bargaining that included torching shearing sheds, sabotage of stagecoaches, and the scuttling of paddle steamers. The ALP's culture mirrored a broader suspicion of intellectuals throughout Australia. It was the product of a pioneering imperative, perhaps, that we didn't take intellectuals too seriously. We rewarded doers rather than thinkers, practical men, the fixers of the fence, as opposed to those who deliver papers on agricultural enclosures. The biggest obstacle for the rapprochement in the early 1960s, however, was Arthur Caldwell, who was anything but stupid, but he was hardly the man to build a bridgehead to the campuses. "I've got nothing against the university education," Arthur Caldwell wrote after his retirement, "but I have many non-university educated people. I've met many non-university educated people who've displayed a much broader knowledge than the doctors, lawyers and economists and others who deserted their professions for politics." By the time the ALP met for its 1965 conference, the intellectual forces had amassed the strength for a showdown. First, Don Dunstan led a move to drop the White Australia policy from the party's platform. Then Whitlam threw open the temp flats to the white-collar professionals in his keynote speech to the conference. "Intellectuals and white-collar people know that their decisions will be more effective and their advice more heeded under Labour," Whitlam told delegates. "This party needs intellectuals, and the intellectuals need this party." It was a defining moment for modern Labour, a marriage of convenience between working and middle classes that looked hopeful at the start but would deteriorate slowly into a deep-seated quarrel. The two sides had radically different expectations. The workers wanted a party that they could trust to do the right thing by them. The intellectuals, on the other hand, signed up to a party that they expected to do the right thing by others, one that would fight oppression wherever it was. One party supported the interests of working people, the other partner fought for the oppressed, the victims of capitalism, sexism, racism, or the victims of a heartless society and a rotten system, the vulnerable who, for whatever reason, had fallen through the cracks. Middle Australia sought security and comfort from Labor. Ben Chifley said that the movement would have fulfilled its purpose if it could make someone more comfortable, to give a father or a mother a greater feeling of security for their children. Yet by the 1960s, the intellectuals had come to see security and comfort as a horrifying prospect. They equated comfort with complacency, contentment with the contentment of suburbia, a sentiment that was against change. The dynamics of progressivism, of course, insist that social and economic justice can never be fully achieved, since that would stop the movement in its tracks. Social reform, therefore, is a never-ending process. Yet, despite the awkwardness of the partnership, the intellectuals needed Labour if they were not to become what Whitlam would later describe in another context, the nation's largest pressure group. On its own, without a political host, the progressive movement would be relegated to insignificance in a robust and unforgiving democracy. It would become, in other words, the Australian Democrats. On balance, it's clear that Labour needed the intellectuals if it was not to become a relic of the past. Whitlam, the moderniser, needed educated men and women, people driven by the power of ideas, capable of delivering a practical programme of reform on social democratic principles. Corbell's crowning achievement, of course, had been to lead Labour to its worst defeat since World War II, and he agreed to step aside. Yet even then, at the start of 1967, the prospect of an openly intellectual candidate running for the leadership of the Workers' Party seemed an extraordinary proposition. Just 2 days before the ballot, Alan Ramsey and John Stubbs predicted in The Australian that Whitlam's middle-class background would be a big problem for him. He was considered by many of the party's rank and file to be an opportunist, Stubbs and Ramsey wrote, a silvertail, a liberal who'd ratted on his own party. Yet Edward Gough Whitlam overcame the impediment of dual degrees to become the duly elected leader of the opposition. Three other intellectuals were chosen as his Praetorian guard, Lance Bernard, Lionel Murphy and Sam Cohen. Ramsey began his splash the next morning in The Australian with the following extraordinary... intellectual coup. He wrote, "It is a break from Labour's tradition and a sweeping victory for the party's new-look politicians." Yet the deep animosity between Corbell and Whitlam, between the old guard and the new, cannot be explained merely as a personality clash or an intergenerational altercation. It was a confrontation of two opposing sets of values and marked an emerging fault line in Australian society, one far wider than the gap between the Labour and Liberal parties. It was a clash between the cosmopolitan values of a growing tertiary educated middle class and the rest of the country, a division between the abstract and the practical, a contest between the wisdom of the academy and the wisdom of the street. Whitlam's capture of the party represented a political victory of progressivism over conservatism, but the victors made one critical mistake. They assumed that social conservatives were finished, that they would inevitably lead to progressive thinking and once the old, crusty old guard had passed away, but they were wrong. The progressive left's reluctance to recognise the endurance of social conservative sentiment has caused it to misread the electorate for more than four decades. It prosecutes its agenda in the arrogant expectation that the popular ignorance will one day be banished and that people can be convinced to change their minds. But by condemning the beliefs of its fellow citizens without trying to understand why they believe what they believe, they've fallen for the fallacy of reason, that reason takes primacy over emotion. The emotions of sanctity, loyalty, decency, respect, which could explain why people hold what the intellectuals believe to be bad ideas, have been largely ignored by the Western Social Democrats since the early 1970s, and they continue to pay the electoral price. Never in Australian political history has a change in leader thrown a party into a handbrake turn as spectacular as the one that occurred when Whitlam grabbed the wheel from Corbell. Yet the philosophical underpinnings of the transition are by necessity downplayed by the party in its official history. It cannot acknowledge that Labour is prone to making a sharp turn in any direction. It would damage the brand of a party that treasures its legacy and uphold and claims to uphold universal and eternal values. Consequently, the party's historians have been unwilling to recognise that Whitlam unilaterally redefined the party. He changed its purpose from... He altered the currency of redistribution from cold, hard cash to the less tangible benefits of health, education and protected rights. 4 months after becoming leader, in his famous speech to the Victorian Party executive, Whitlam declared, "Wages and conditions are no longer the chief determinants of real living standards." It was a breathtaking claim. The things for which Labour had fought for 80 years had been accomplished. Whitlam continued, "The health and housing of ourselves and our families, our children's education, represent the most important social capital this nation has to offer. The things the government provide are those which determine whether the community enjoys a true measure of equality." Modern Labour had begun its quest for social justice that substantially was to enlarge the role of government. Whitlam would pick up where Chifley left off, with one difference. Rather than nationalise the banks and the airlines, he'd nationalise the business of everyday life. Whitlam continued, "The quality of life depends less on the things which individuals obtain for themselves and more on the things which the community provides for all its members from the combined resources of the community." Whitlam's speechwriter Graham Freudenberg wrote, "From that night on, nothing would ever be the same for the Labour Party." Indeed, Whitlam's election campaign speech in the 1969 election, delivered on the 1st of October at Sydney Town Hall, marks, I believe, a turning point in politics. For the first time since Andrew Fisher, an ALP leader abandoned the rhetoric of stability and fashioned an agenda around the narrative of change. His 12,200-word address is a fiscal, monetary and budgetary commercial-free zone. Employment gets a passing mention as Whitlam promises a parliamentary inquiry into Aboriginal welfare. The only reference to business is in connection with the government-owned post office. Trade crops up three times when Whitlam praises the vital work of the government-controlled shipping company ANL. In short, it's a platform for the cognoscenti, promising nothing less than a crusade to give all our people the opportunities to which they are entitled in a rich and growing nation. In place of steadiness, security and solidity, Whitlam offers renovation, rejuvenation and reinvigoration in a world where opportunity will be equalised, democracy revitalised and dignity restored. Labour's fortunes since Whitlam demonstrate the folly of those assumptions. When Labour oppositions have campaigned on jobs and wages and conditions, Labour's code, if you like, for sound economic management, it wins government. As Bob Hawke did in 1983, Kevin Rudd did 24 years later. Yet there always remains this propensity for the party to go astray, to drift off on some progressive adventure. And it takes it away from the concerns of everyday men and women. It did so in 1983 when Labour attached itself to the deep ecological forces opposing the Franklin Dam. That decision cost Hawke votes. There was a 4% swing to Labour in 1983 across the country, but it was reversed in Tasmania, a 4% swing away from Labour. It was an early lesson for the party that green politics could not just be sprinkled like glitter, and that tree-hugging photo opportunities exact a price. Philosophically, at least, ecologism was even less compatible with democratic socialism than communism. Marx, after all, only wanted to take over the factories. The Greens want to close them down. Yet broadly, Labour failed to see the danger, seeing that nature conservation was a useful tool to wedge the coalition and turn the environment into a partisan issue. Old Labour figures, like Hawke's first Environment Minister, Barry Cohen, were cautious about overplaying their hand, but his successor, Graham Richardson, saw no reason for holding back. He wrote, "We had the perfect convergence. What was right was also popular." Yet, as Richardson was to discover, the causes dearest to the hearts of nature lovers can be brutally unpopular with the workers. And as Peter Walsh reminds us in his memoirs, the demands of the ecological movement are insatiable. Every compromise, every agreement is seen by them to be no more than a launching pad for another assault on industry and employment. Thus, a Labour government knowingly put South Tasmanian blue-collar workers living in an area which already had an unemployment rate of between 20 and 24% out of work, not for any valid environmental reasons, but to appease bourgeois left and middle-class trendoids in the gentrified suburbs of Sydney and Melbourne. In the rarefied atmosphere of federal politics, it was becoming increasingly difficult to distinguish between the practical interests of the working people and the symbols that fascinated the middle classes. The party had begun to construct a new philosophy of failure. It was in danger of forgetting Whitlam's foundation principle, certainly the impotent are pure. Just to step back for a moment from the contemporary political circus, it seems clear that Labour's political crisis is directly linked to the pursuit of progressive ideas. On the touchstone issues of the environment, immigration, it's chosen the sophisticates' applause ahead of pragmatic social conservatism of the masses. The fact that Julia Gillard felt able to enter into a formal alliance with the Greens shows how removed the broader political class has become. Belatedly, in 2012, senior members of a disorganised and demoralised Labour Party began to repudiate the folly of seeking that alliance. New South Wales Party Secretary Sam Dastyari told The Weekend Australian, "We're kidding ourselves if we think they, the Greens, are our friends. The Greens are, to the left, what Pauline Hanson and One Nation are to the right. They share the same ridiculous, albeit different, economic agendas." It's impossible to explain the drift of the progressive movement within Labour without considering the climate of the debate in the nation's principal cultural institutions, the universities and the ABC, where public investment in cultural capital was producing peculiar results. New recruits to the political class were themselves products of the same degree factories and had received the same narrow, unimaginative educations. The media class and the political class were cut from the same cloth. People were more interested in ideas than things. They were fascinated with the abstract rather than the concrete. They were graduates who'd chosen to work in the creative sector, as is distinct from the wealth-creating sector. Rather than challenging and probing the tendacious progressive arguments, politicians, professors and producers have reinforced one another's prejudices and encouraged a false certainty. If the ABC really is Labour's best friend, as some suggest, it's the worst friend they could possibly have. If nothing else, I think Kevin Rudd's second coming may at least have broken the spell of the Messiah complex. I detect little optimism within the party or its supporters that Mr. Rudd offers a path for redemption, even if he should contrive an unlikely election win, which is probably unlikely. Mark Latham, in a hard-hitting review piece in the Australian Financial Review on Saturday, sheeted the problems home to the breakdown of factional discipline and unprincipled personal ambition in the party. Perhaps, but that's only a symptom, in my view, not the problem itself. To find out what's at the heart of Labour's crisis, you can do worse and go back to Latham's previous analysis in From the Suburbs, which is a book which is now 10 years old. Latham correctly identifies the emergence of a new influential group in the 1970s who found a home in higher education, public broadcasting and other cultural programmes. "These are the new insiders," says Latham, "the progressive establishment, led by academics, artists and other cultural producers." He writes, "They have little experience of suburban life or suburban values. They practice a symbolic, abstract style of politics. They dominate the debate. The dividing line in public life is not the question of left versus right, but it is a struggle between the insiders and the outsiders." Where should Labour be making its home on this new cultural landscape? Clearly, it is where Latham said it should be, where it always used to be, shaking the tree and rattling the cage on the outsiders' behalf. "Our job," said Latham, "is to give them hell." Thank you.
Thanks, all the latecomers can come in and show themselves and stand up against the wall over
just
here.
Get some cheese.
Latecomers, you're all welcome to come in. You should come in and stand against the wall and just fess up that you were late. Okay. Here we come. All
is
come through.
There?
Now, while we're doing this, Janet Grundy's got some copies of
there,
The Lucky
Elizabeth.
Culture, The Rise and of an Australian Ruling Class, and I'm sure Nick would be happy to sign any copies later. So come through. You're all welcome. Come through. Latecomers, in you come. Any other latecomers out there? Anyone else want to be shamed?
Sarah.
Okay. Up against the wall here. There's a chair here. Come in. Come in. Come in. Come in. Quickly.
Come on, Dominic.
Dominic, in you come. In you come. You were the latest of all. So you can sit up there. Okay. That's great. Many thanks to Mellisons for the use of this place tonight. We got here at late notice. We're very grateful they could accommodate us. We have too many people, but we're grateful you're here. So many thanks to King and Wood Mellisons for tonight. And so we come to questions and discussion. If I could lead off, it seems you mentioned you covered Whitlam and you covered Hawke and Keating, but it seemed to me that one of the great motivating factors for the successful Labor leaders of Bill Hayden, Bob Hawke, Paul Keating, and people who work with them like Peter Walsh and others was that they were not going to be like Whitlam. That was what drove that Hawke and Keating government, which I think was a very successful government, that they weren't going to be like Whitlam. But it seems to me that the next generation of Labor leaders, which is Kevin Rudd and Julia Gillard, don't have that attitude to Whitlam that Hawke and Keating and Hayden and Walsh had, the older generation. How did your own research come up on that?
I think that's exactly right, Gerard. And as I said, it seems to me that when Labor campaigns on jobs and prosperity, it wins elections, and when it doesn't, it loses them. It did so, of course, in 1983 because there was a recession or there was a slowdown in the economy, high unemployment. That was the natural message that Hawke went in with. And he did so again in 2007, more out of accident than by design, I think. Kevin Rudd had the chance to campaign effectively on job security. But that was really against, I think, the natural instincts of the current leaders of the Labour Party. Certainly, as we've seen with Julia Gillard, surprisingly, I think, to many, given her background in trade union law, she seemed to have a tin ear towards those things and a fascination with the projects that were exciting the sophisticates. And worryingly, I think, well, I guess, well, I won't say worryingly, we always want to be optimistic, but let's look forward to the next generation of Labour people. I note that yesterday was a historic moment. It was the passing of the last physical link, if you like, within the party and the party of Hawke and Keating with the decision of Simon Crean to step down at the next election. So they'll go in, whatever happens at the next election, they will go into the next term of government or opposition, minus anybody with experience of that Hawke and Keating period. And I think increasingly confused. Intellectually, I think many of them, including Rudd, understand the importance of this economic imperative and that you can't separate social reform from economic reform and that somehow you have to sell whatever economic reforms are needed in Labour terms. But in practical terms, they seem to lack the stamina to prosecute these things in the way that Keating was prepared to do, and endlessly captivated by the progressive schemes. Not surprisingly, perhaps, because almost every Member of Parliament now, in fact, a Labour Member of Parliament, comes from a university background. I think the figure I looked at was something around 70% of Labour people have a university degree. 36% of them have law degrees. Only one of them has a trade certificate, poor old Dick Adams, who apparently is quite a good butcher, I bet.
Could be handy. Rafe.
A couple of comments followed by questions.
Very brief ones, Rafe. Yeah, come on. Okay.
The spectacular vindication of your thesis was the way that Keating lost the election of 1996 after he won the unwinnable election of 1983. I mean, he became a cultural messiah and he went down.
But yeah, we used to talk about the big picture, didn't we? Yeah.
Second thing is, and this is
brief. You've got to be brief.
Okay, I'll give
another
tick, that'll do.
Right. A brilliantly formulated question.
I think I have to say that I didn't set out to write a complete history of the Labour Party, so I kind of jumped a few years and didn't look closely at those later Keating years, but my recollection of them, having lived through them here and reported on them, was exactly as you say, that Keating became less enamoured with the practical concerns of reforming the economy, and more excited by what in Whitlam's day they would have called special projects.
So we go to this question here. Yep.
Given your experience and opinions in writing about the history so far away from me anyway, and having lived through this latest round of Labor government, do you think the next Labor government, we've got any members that are sitting at the moment, and what do you think it'll look like? Do you think they'll fix their act? Do you think they'll make and have such an amazing reformation like they had under Hawke Keating? Do you think it's likely to happen again, I guess is my question.
Well, you hesitate to make predictions, but if you look at their situation now, of course, between Whitlam and Hawke, there was Hayden. And Hayden was in place in the last year of the Whitlam government. He was treasurer. Some people say that last budget that he produced was a brilliant budget. It was right, just what Whitlam needed, but of course, too late. And then Hayden was the bridge, and he set about bringing the Labour Party back to basics. Got them back into contention within 8 years. So who's the Hayden figure now? It's hard to see one. I mean, it might be Chris Bowen, perhaps, but who knows? I mean, there's no one of that capability. So, and as I say, you've now got this incredible situation, which we've seen really over the last week, with so many experienced people going, that you wonder who's going to be there to pick up the reins. I mean, I suppose if I look, and I'm not in the prediction business, but if you look ahead for the future of the Labour Party, I think it's going to be It's almost certainly going to be a smaller party, and then you wonder what's going to come in its place, whether there'll be another party of some nature, or whether the Libs just pick up that entire blue-collar, middle Australian vote, as they seem to be picking up much of it at the moment.
Alice Grundy?
You mentioned Gough Whitlam as being a brand, and one of the early instances of a politician as brand, and Kevin 07 was a pretty convincing brand for some people. What effect do you think the branding of a politician becoming Prime Minister has on their relationship with the electorate? And how does that go for this time round with the election?
Well, I think it'd be a useful thing, but it can also be used, I think, to cover up, these deep-seated problems about what you do represent, what your values are. And also, I think it contributes to this idea that politicians are becoming a little too slick by half. Time and time again, you see that the politicians that excite the media are not necessarily the ones that interest other people. The politicians that get elected are often quite dull in comparison. I mean, you think of Hayden himself or John Howard. They're not men who exude charisma, and yet people trust them. So, I think that's the danger. In seeking for this messiah, this great brand, you overlook, the very basic fact that, in fact, people want somebody they can trust in there.
Question here.
Jared McManus-Smith. I refer this question back to another great seminal book, which was written by Jared Henderson, which was Centenary and the Bishops. And basically, part of the premise for those people staying in the Labor Party in New South Wales, right, is that they said that we would look after the party. The party would be looked after. We've got a luminary here tonight. But the question I have is, how much do you think is the abrogation, the problem of the Labor Party is the abrogation of responsibility of the New South Wales right, which have now allowed the people like the Richardsons and the Abedes and all these sorts of people into the Labor Party, where it's all about winning, but there's no sort of ethical or foundation to the party anymore.
Yeah, as I say, my book is not really about politics, but that's certainly the case, I think. But I wonder whether actually what we're seeing there, you know, is reflecting a deeper sort of malaise about what the party stands for. And look, it's not peculiar to Labour. I think that the non-Labour side of politics also needs a much clearer idea of what it stands for in this post-Cold War era. You know, we've gone for these brands now, or these values, these valence statements, as the American political sociologist call them, which don't mean much at all when you get down to it, you know. So I'd like to see much more vigorous, rigorous intellectual work on both sides of Parliament, both sides of the political divide, on this question of what do you actually stand for. And once you've got that in mind, then you're going to be less driven by people who just stand for themselves, I think.
And the question was essentially that the New South Wales right hadn't really stood for much, I think.
Anymore.
Question there.
The relationship with the Greens has been problematic for Labor. Do you think they've sort of learnt their lesson? Can they live without?
Well, I think they have, yeah. I mean, I think you look at the statements. You know, it took me a dreadfully long time to write this book. So I was working on these ideas, 3 years ago, really. And then last year, when I was middle of last year, about this time last year, in fact, Dastyari came out with that statement. There seemed to be a sudden recognition in Labour amongst the hardheads that this had not just been not a good idea, but a very, very bad idea, and a realisation that the Greens weren't just another couple of notches ahead along this sort of theoretical left-right divide, but were just a completely different species with completely different agenda and a entirely different way of looking at the world, one that was completely unhelpful to people who actually wanted to earn a living.
Question down the back.
In relation to the description of blue-collar workers, is part of the problem the fact that a significant part of that electoral segment now become aspirational in their endeavours of work, and that consequently a significant interest in the Labour Party is not like it was?
Yeah, it's certainly true. There are structural changes, democratic structural changes. I mean, I think they always were aspirational. I think that's a natural human condition. It's what drove this country from 1788 onwards, and probably before. But because you've seen this, well, a decline in strictly blue collar manual jobs for a start, more growth in the service sector. You've seen the small. You've seen tradesmen become small businessmen. You know, contractors. All that, of course, has just broken the Labour Party's business model, if you like, of having a large industrial working class base, and the unions are now, small and thoroughly unrepresentative and unhelpful to Labour. I mean, I think I would imagine the unions were once their conduit to how people thought and their aspirations. Now, of course, they're entirely irrelevant. They're just a small sectional interest. So, yes, that has been a problem with Labour, and Labour hasn't moved with the times. I mean, I think its big problem is not to latch on to the small business constituency, because that's what many of the traditional workers have become. It's also, of course, what a lot of the migrant community have become, and yet Labour has no message for small business. In fact, it's seen, I think, by many as being anti-small business. Probably its way forward is to do that. As I believe, I haven't looked at this closely, but I think that's what the Democrats have done to a large extent in the States, have got this idea of the small business concerns out there and have reaped the benefit.
Yes, I see Australian politics as you get the Libs in for a while and they encourage business makes money and they go along. So when they've made quite a bit of money, you pop Labor in for a while and they spread some of that money around and then you go back to the Libs to make money again.
The magic pudding theory.
Yes, it's certainly been true this government, I think. But I think, as I say, I mean, I think the great break in that narrative is the Hawke and Keating period, which was, you know, did I think for Australia what Thatcher did for Britain, but in much less destructive and divisive ways. So I think you have to recognise that Labour is not only capable of it, but it's also in its self-interest, because when it governs that way, it's successful.
If I go down the back, you've had, I think, Chris Bowen launched your book in the Western Suburbs. What did he have to say?
Well, Chris, I think he bought half the theory. I mean, he bought the sociological side as he saw it. I mean, he recognised that there was this large cohort now of university-educated people who tended to think in a completely different way to their predecessors or to their fellow citizens. And he recognised that they had been an influence on Labour, and that there needs to be a balance and a reconciliation between the two camps. I think what we backed away from was that the idea that Labour had been somehow captured and ruined by this constituency. You know, he held to the idea that there was still balance within the party. But I find it hard to see that balance anymore. I just can't see who the forces are pulling the party the other way. It seems to be dominated, I think, by people with one narrow view of the world.
Down the back. Yes.
One's a quick one. I'm a musician and artist. I'm probably the most impactful person in the room. But my question is, with Rudd back in, there are two ways to win an election, I suppose. One is with a personality cult, as you say, and the other is with policy. Will Rudd getting back in create a personality cult style election again, or will everybody decide on policy?
Well, he has that, doesn't he? But I'm not sure whether that's going to be enough in this case. You know, the huge gap between the preferred Prime Minister rating and the primary vote. I mean, he celebrated. I mean, Monday's news poll, when Labour got 35% primary vote, was seen as a great triumph for the party. And yet, of course, 35% was what he was chucked out on. You know, so he's got some ground to make up. And you know, I sense, it's hard to gauge these things, but you sense that people have seen through this more and more. That they're not easily led on these things anymore, and probably want a more boring leader, I would think.
Right, so there's a question here.
Yes, Nick, can you elaborate on the base of the Green Party and how you see them going from the demographic?
It's a question about the Greens.
The Green Party's the best. It's got the best educated, if you like, educated membership of any party in the country. There's a very, very strong coalition between the primary Green vote and the number of people with a university degree in any given constituency. I think it's something like 0.7 for those of you who understand correlations, which is amazingly strong. I mean, it is almost overwhelmingly the party of the educated middle classes. A similar demographic to the Democrats in many ways. I mean, I think people... until I wrote the book, I think I was under the impression that they were largely sort of long-haired people who sat out on the street with the Occupy movement. But it's not so. I wanted to get a gauge of this. I went to Fitzroy North, and Fitzroy North Primary School has the highest Green vote in the country, 49% primary vote. Walked up and down the street. It was a Sunday morning. There was nobody about. But you know, you wouldn't believe the cars and the gentrification of the houses up and down there. These are doctors, lawyers, those kind of people. That's the heart of the Green vote, I think. So it's not to be taken lightly.
Fitzroy North, as you know, was once the heart of the Labour Party in Melbourne.
Yeah. Mm.
Anne?
Your thesis about university education is good, but more and more there is this what we call political class, and fewer and fewer of our MPs have actually ever earned any money for their own organisation. I mean, they've actually not had that experience of having to work in a business or earn money. To what extent is this the problem when it comes to their idea of economic reform, the idea of welfare reform, the idea that we do have magic pudding and all we have to do is sort of create a bit more money and offer a few more services? I mean, we've really got these highly educated people who've actually never had to go out and form their own business or work in a business and haven't got any idea really how money is created.
Yeah, that's self-evidently true. I think that a successful party though will recognise that and will deliberately counteract it. If you look at the MPs in Parliament, then Tony Abbott would be sort of typical political class material. I mean, he hasn't really done much else, has he, except his seminary work and so forth. But
he worked for Ball. Was he a journalist?
I did, yeah.
He's
but
a journalist.
That's my point. That's my very point.
No, but he had to actually earn some money to keep going. I mean, he had to put money in his pocket. He didn't just have a full-time job at a university.
Possibly so, but
and
I think...
he ran Australians for Constitutional Monarchy, which was a kind of a small business.
He had to raise money.
Yeah, yeah. Possibly so, but I see Abbott's story as him, you know, making a deliberate decision to connect with the aspirations of the broader constituency. I mean, he spends a lot of time mixing in the community more than most. So my point is simply to say it's not impossible to be a member of the political class and be a good, responsive politician, but it's hard. And particularly, I think, when you get now this overwhelming bubble, you know, everybody's in that class and everybody reinforces one another's assumptions and thinks the same way. So yes, it's a big problem. A big problem.
There's a question here? Yes.
Considering we have such a big social agenda to fund, is it not time, and it may be that I don't understand it, but there seems to be a need to have an audit of unemployment or employment.
Not in the government sector, yeah.
Well, employment, there appears to be the anecdotal evidence of employment seems, of people being unemployed seems to be not in line with the employment statistics that come out,
yeah.
Such that should we not know some more breakdown of hours worked and, full employment, part-time employment, etc., because they don't seem to be readily available.
No, I think that's right. And I think that we seem to be very loath to empirically test all these many social programs that we put in. It's just simply enough to have the good intention.
Is it not time for an audit, though?
Oh, I think so. That's a political question, I guess.
Now, we're getting right to the end, so I'll ask the final... Ian.
Nick, it may amaze you to know that political life in Australia didn't commence in 1989 with Bill's arrival.
Oh, didn't it?
There were many of us who had more than half our lives before then. But I think this is almost a truism that the big political fights, you know, in my lifetime, Chipkin was going to nationalise the banks, there was a communist referendum, there was an enormous split in the Labour Party in the 50s, there was the Vietnam War and various other issues, but the fact that I see, and picking up the question at the back, is that the major policy areas of both major parties become so close together that all you've really got left is personality, trust, decency, all these right-brain things. You know, the slogan of the Liberal Party, presumably about to come in, is hope, reward and opportunity, and finally have granted any of those. So how do you do other, if you're Rudd or Abbott, than compete on personality grounds when policies have come so close together now?
Well, I think this goes to the point I made earlier, that both parties need to work harder, because plainly they're not the same. They're not the same philosophically, but they come together in the middle there with the policies. But, I spent some time sort of thinking about what the divide is. It seems the closest I can get to it is what are you most concerned about? What do you think the biggest threat to personal liberty is? Do you think it's corporations or do you think it's government? And that seems to me to be a fair dividing line. But it goes to a deep philosophical question. So I don't think it's impossible for a party to develop a strong philosophical basis. And indeed, the Liberal Party, I believe, has one pretty much ready-made, the one that was outlined by Menzies, which is, you know, just when I read that and read it again, is a very clear and intelligent statement of a clear set of values and principles to which I think a lot of people would sign up to.
Finally, this book has been very successful. You've had more book launches than Dame Millie Melba had farewells, I think is true to say. So what's next?
Well, sell more copies of this one, and then I am contracted to write another book. It might take some time. And I've kind of played around with a few ideas on that one. But I've enjoyed, to speak personally, I've enjoyed being able to not just write a book, but have it actually make some contribution, I think, in a minor way to the discussion, and hopefully some more. It's funny when you write a book, because you think the whole thing's entirely non-controversial, because it's all out of your own head. So it's nice to realise that it does cause controversy and discussion, and I hope much more, because genuinely that's what I want. You know, you don't want everybody to simply nod.
Many thanks, Nick.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.